Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. My guest this week on the telephone from his office in Crawfordsville is Mayor Todd Barton. Mr. Mayor, good afternoon to you. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Good afternoon.
We appreciate you being with us, as always. And if you've got a question when you're listening to our conversation with Mayor Barton over the next half hour, you can call us at 496-1999. You can send an email to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Let me start with a caller who called us yesterday with a question for you, wanting to get back to our conversations that we've had over the last couple of months about trains going through town and sometimes stopping in inconvenient places. The caller wanted to know a couple of things. One, are there regulations on how long a train can be when it goes through town? And is there any sort of way you can limit the length?
There are currently no regulations on the local level as far as the length of a train. I'm sure, you know, the Federal Railroad Administration has some regulations there, but nothing on the local level. And it's important to keep in mind that the courts have been very consistent in their view that local governments cannot interfere with interstate commerce. So our ability there gets pretty limited in what we can and can't do. And certainly there are state codes and local ordinances about obstructing, you know, crossings and things like that. But what you run into, there are always some loopholes in those for mechanical failures and unforeseen circumstances. And it becomes a real gray area that's difficult to enforce.
Any sort of a limit on the amount of time, for instance, a train could be sitting in an intersection stalling traffic?
Well, we do. I mean, state law limits that, and we limit that. However, if you look, in both instances, you must carve out exceptions for mechanical failures. When this occurs, it's basically, you know, the railroad's word that this was caused by a mechanical failure. So we've not had much luck enforcing those, and we've tried for many decades. The city of Crawfordsville has cited rail personnel, cited train crews with no change to behavior at all. So we don't really think that's the direction that's probably going to be successful based on history. It seems to be more in a situation of let's get these crossings separated, let's get the grades separated, let's make sure that we have the proper switches in our community and automated systems to move through, the rail traffic through quickly and efficiently.
I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know what the legality of this whole thing is, but even if you were the railroad and you were saying that it's a mechanical problem that is causing these trains to stall across intersections time and time again, it would seem like there would have to be some recourse at some point where the city or individual people who are made late by the trains could go back and say, the poor performance of this company in terms of keeping its rolling stock, you know, operating in a way that it can move through town is actually costing us time and money and it's an inconvenience. And I have to think there's some sort of legal backing there to say, look, if you're that bad at your job, at
right.
some point, that's not a defense any longer.
Right. You know, and one would think that. I think we all kind of, that's kind of common sense to think that way. We've had our legal team really look at case history throughout Indiana and other states. And unfortunately, we are the underdog in this situation. You know, when the railroads were put in place, there was all this protection, you know, to keep locals from, you know, interfering with interstate commerce. And it certainly to this day gives them the upper hand. And we've looked at those situations. We've looked at that kind of litigation. And we just haven't found anything that we're real comfortable that we can, you know, move forward with and make something happen. But that's not to say we don't continue. We do continue. And I think in all fairness, I think it's important to acknowledge that the amount of blocked crossings that we've had in our community has decreased significantly over the last few months. Now, I say that and something bad will happen today, but we are not seeing the blockages that we were seeing there for a while. And I'm confident in saying that because we do record we do have video footage of our primary crossing, and so we can easily go back and look and see when it's being blocked and when it's not. So we think the situation is getting better. We think the automated switching will help and some improved signaling will help, and then just keep pressuring on the state level to really get, you know, some of these crossings separated out and put an overpass in.
After our show last month with you, I called CSX and I got on the phone with a spokeswoman, and she said, quite through gritted teeth, and as she was trying feverishly to get off the phone with me, she said, "No, Mayor Barton is a very good advocate for his town," and that's all she would say. It's a nice way of saying that you've been in their ear a lot, I think.
I have been in their ear a lot, and I think we make some progress. It gets a little frustrating sometimes. It's like, you know, a couple of steps forward and one or two backwards some days, but we are making progress. And you know, you just have to understand that it's a huge corporation, and you might talk to one person and get one answer, and you go down the list, and you talk to somebody else, and it's totally different. So, you know, I try to understand that. I try to work within their system and keep moving forward. But what I always tell everybody in our community, you know, they need to hear from everyone who's been inconvenienced, not just me. You know, and Crawfordsville is just a blip on the map for them. So. We are making progress. We are making headway, and it'll keep getting better, I hope.
On to another business issue. Let's talk about the opening this week of a new 20-acre solar farm on your city's northeast side. Do you see this as the first of a series of solar investments, or is it kind of the one that you think you'll have for a while?
Well, both. You know, I think this is certainly going to be there for a while. If you look at the lifespan of these solar panels, you know, I think they're guaranteed 100% efficiency for like 20 years. And then, you know, the data shows that they'll still remain active in producing energy for maybe 60 years. And you might reduce efficiency and only be getting, you know, 85, 90%, you know, the power. But it's still sitting there producing. So we think this will be here a long time. We also feel very comfortable that where we've positioned it, there's room for expansion. And what we're seeing is that not all communities are embracing this. So we think we're well positioned. If other communities do not embrace this, that we'll be able to pull that investment here and expand what we have. So there's room out there to easily double what we've done already.
I wanted to ask you about that, because one of the things, aside from the Stellar Communities designation, that I think Crawfordsville could have and might need is more of an identity. You don't have too much of a rallying cry outside of perhaps being the home of Wabash College or Lew Wallace, something like that. And even those are kind of tenuous in terms of what is your identity. Do you think that alternative energy could be that thing? Could you make yourself one of the centers of green technology, alternative energy generation, something like that? Is that a viable goal for the city going forward?
Well, perhaps that's maybe possible. I really think it has to be part of a much bigger picture. I think we have to really carve ourselves out as being, a progressive community, a community that's looking to the future, that's offering these types of things, and really being innovative and getting out ahead of the curve. And I think, by all means, the alternative energy can be a part of that equation. You know, people today want to see communities that are doing those kinds of things, and this certainly puts us out there as a forerunner in that area. But I think I'm not sure that in itself will do it, but I think it could be a part of the overall package.
When you say the P word, progressive, do your fellow Republicans get mad at you?
Well, you know, I think it's all in how you use the word, but, you know, I think any of them will tell you they want progress. So I don't know if you're thinking of it, you know, in that term, it kind of makes more sense to them. So, I'm not going to say everybody agrees with me on everything, because certainly they don't, but we have to move this community forward, and I think we've already set the stage and we're starting to do that.
You mentioned the idea of the efficiency of these solar panels having a lifespan on them, and of course you're talking about a percentage there, because one of the big problems that solar panels have had for a long time is they are only partially effective. Even the most efficient solar panels out there are 30 to 40% efficient in terms of the amount of energy the sun is actually hitting them with and the amount they are then transferring back into the grid. Did you ask any questions of the company about the efficiency of these solar panels and or the ability to replace them with more efficient models when things come along down the line?
We didn't really spend much time on that particular issue. You know, we were really driven by a couple of things there. I mean, obviously, you can improve the efficiency if you have articulating panels that follow the sun and those kinds of things. But we heard pretty loudly from the residents adjoining the park that they didn't really want noise, they didn't want movement, they didn't want those kinds of things. So that kind of took that off the table. I have the utmost confidence in Indiana Municipal Power Agency that they are really providing the most effective, efficient way of doing this, and so we just really, you know, kept our confidence in them, and really we were looking at that cost. You know, what is the cost per kilowatt to produce energy in this fashion? Because most of the time you find these operations and they're producing at a much higher rate than what you can buy power off the grid. So that makes it even though we want green power, that makes it a really difficult decision. Are you going to do it at a loss? Are people willing to pay more? Is industry willing to pay more? So we really had to factor that in. And when they're able to come in at less than 7 cents per kilowatt hour, that is very attractive because that equals what we can buy it from the grid or maybe even beats it in some cases. So we were really focused on the economic performance side of it.
There were definitely some comments made earlier this week about the city's proposals and your negotiations trying to lower the cost of entry into the market and the cost of being able to provide the power for people. How did you weigh some of those concerns? Because certainly, as you pointed out, you could have made the cells a little more efficient by having them follow the sun. Would that have been useful to you to go back to those people and say, hey, we could make this even a little bit cheaper if we do X, Y, or Z for you?
Well, if you looked at the numbers, that didn't really, I mean, they would have been more efficient, but you also have more expense involved. So when you weigh all that out, the added expense, you know, when you're looking solely from the economic side of this, didn't really bear out that it was worth the extra expense, you know, to do that just to gain, you know, a little bit more efficiency. And then you also know you're up against, you know, the wishes of the adjoining neighborhood. And we did listen to them, and we have listened to them, you know, for the last few years about that particular area. So to me, it just made sense to keep those stationary, stable, don't add the extra cost of the articulating. And again, if you look at the experience of other communities, when they put the articulating panels in, they start running into much higher maintenance costs. You know, they can easily be damaged, and then the wind gets involved, and in the winter they freeze, and a lot of things involved there that we're not sure we really wanted to deal with. It just made more sense to have those stationary and control the cost and move forward.
How much extra tax revenue from having these on the land now that used to be vacant is the city expecting to realize on a yearly basis?
Well, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but you know, if you look at the amount of investment there, and so we put a tax abatement in, and obviously it's 100% the first year, so we won't see anything this year. But starting next year, you will see, you know, increasing percentages of that. And the interesting thing in this particular case, not only was it vacant land, it was land owned by the county, so it was producing zero, and it's been held by the county for many, many years, just sitting there. They rented it out to be farmed, and there was, you know, very little income coming off of that into the community. This will change that equation dramatically. You know, and I apologize, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but it's a significant amount of investment when you start talking about, you know, several millions of dollars to capture the tax revenue off of that is certainly nothing to blink at.
It got me to thinking about how that sort of land that's either so far out that it's not within a city's boundaries or it's not viable for development in terms of commercial property where you're not going to put a business or a home on it, something like that, how that land is used going forward. I think about these reclaimed landfills, for instance. There have been lots of examples in the last 10 or 20 years of where you've got a landfill that then gets covered over by soil and you plant grass on top of it and you make it look much, much nicer than just a giant pile of garbage. And I wondered, can you do things like find land like that and put solar panels or wind turbines or things on it, and there you use the land that might otherwise have gone useless to you in a way that actually develops some money for the city or some power for the grid or things like that?
Right.
Is that a part of a consideration?
Oh, it is part of the consideration, and the location of this park really adjoins our former landfill. You know, and we did give some consideration to putting this at the former landfill. And I'm not going to say that that's not out of the question down the road if there's more and more expansion of the solar farm, that we might end up in that landfill space, because you're right, it is just, it's dormant. It just sits there. I think probably for me the deciding factor right now, you know, when you when you want to do something like this and you want to move it forward and make it happen in a reasonable amount of time, putting it on the landfill is certainly going to slow you down because there are a lot of considerations there. You don't just come and drive steel posts into the ground in a former landfill. We monitor that former landfill. You know, we have companies that come in and monitor for us, and we're very aware of that situation, and we don't want to disturb anything and cause a spill, cause a leak, you know, cause this to start shifting. So we took it off the table, but it could happen down the road.
Well, now you have to figure out how to capture the methane gas from that landfill and make it useful to you.
Oh, absolutely. And there have been some experiments with that over the years, and we know it's out there. You know, it's just finding the right person, the right group that wants to come in and really try to work with that.
You're listening to Ask the Mayor on WBAA. Our guest this afternoon is Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. We'd love to have your questions for him. You can call them in at 765-496-1999. You can send an email to ask@wbaa.org, and you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Well, even though I felt like going into today's program, I maybe had run out of questions about Stellar, it turns out that's not true. So let me ask a few more.
Okay.
Has anyone come up to you at any point and actually been critical of your plans or said they didn't want Stellar to happen in Crawfordsville for any reason? So I'm just trying to play devil's advocate to this whole thing.
You know, I've not really had anybody come up and say they didn't want it. You know, I've heard from a few people who don't believe, you know, in taking grant money in general. You know, I think maybe there was a letter to the editor in which somebody says, I feel like we've been bribed with our own money. And I understand that there are people out there with that view. My answer to that is always that, you know, this community has been paying into that system. We pay our taxes and we send money to Indianapolis and Washington, D.C., you know, every year in massive amounts. And I think we've always been on the losing end of that. I don't think we pull back what we're sending, and this just kind of offsets that a little bit. They typically say that because they'll say that if you take that money, then, you know, they're going to tell you what you can and can't do and who you can and can't hire. And I always kind of turn that question back on them and ask them what they're asking us to do that is so objectionable to them. So that argument tends to die out pretty quickly. But so we've heard that a little bit. And then the biggest thing that I've heard is I mean, and on the, you know, concern side is, you know, hey, you have all this money, you know, you're going to put something over in this part of town. Why don't you move it to the other side? Move it to my side, you know, that kind of thing. So you will hear some people ask about the plans in that regard. And you know, I talked to someone this morning that said, you know, the trail's on the west side. We really need it on the east side, those kind of things. And you just have to walk through and explain to them how you've made this decision and how you've moved it forward and really what it means for the community as a whole. And it is just setting the stage. So we will be getting to the east side and getting to the north side and all those areas. So that's primarily what we hear.
You noted that the designation puts your city at the front of the line for some existing grant funding. Have you begun applying for those grants yet, or maybe even receiving preliminary correspondence about them?
You know, we received a letter today saying, you know, you're approved for this amount through this one group, this one agency. So that's kind of a first sign. That really begins next week. We meet early next week with all the state agencies, what's known as a kickoff meeting that really starts the process where you dig in and start making these things happen. So starting next week, that process will be fully underway.
Do you have any idea how many different grants you're talking about, like how many pots of money you're eventually going to have to pull from?
Well, I, you know, as far as individual grants, I would have to really sit down and think about that. But I can tell you that we're pulling from sources such as the Office of Community and Rural Affairs, probably from two or three sources there. NDOT, probably two or three sources there. The Indiana Housing and Community Development Authority, one or two sources there. So you really have to work through the agencies. And then a lot of the agencies are bringing the technical support to the table, you know, the guidance and things like that. And sometimes it's hard to really calculate the value on those services. But it is being pulled from multiple different agencies through multiple different programs.
When you get into that meeting next week, is there a point at which you're still going to have to keep selling your city and selling your program to try to wring as many of these grant dollars out as you can?
Oh, absolutely. We will never stop doing that. You know, and the experience in looking at other communities, if you are managing this well and you're doing a good job, you could end up, you know, certainly getting everything that you've asked and maybe even more. If you are struggling with that, you might not get fully what you thought you might get. So we'll be putting the sell on throughout this process. That'll never stop.
Were there at any point during this some people's, for lack of a better term here, and I apologize for this term, pet projects that they wanted done that didn't wind up in your final plan, and you've had to explain to those people, no, we don't have the money for this, or no, you're going to have to wait a little bit longer, or no, this just isn't a priority for the city?
You know, I don't think we've really seen that. I don't really recall any, you know, type of pet projects or special interest projects. Now, that's not to say, you know, since we've been designated, you know, that people haven't come forward and say, you know, hey, my goodness, you have all this money. Why don't you do this over here? Or why don't you do that? And when we stop and really educate them that, you know, we didn't win the lottery and now we have to decide how to spend the money, we were chosen because we put a plan together, and they chose that plan. They liked that plan. So now I have to follow that plan, and if I try to deviate too much, I'm probably not going to get funded. So when we explain it in that context, people tend to understand. But what I'm seeing is people coming forward with other projects and asking how to not necessarily directly fund those, but marry those up and capture that synergy and become a part of it. And we've already had a couple of three, you know, ideas come forward that I think are all very good ideas that we can, you know, really go out and hit the private sources and some other potential sources and try to capture this this collective energy and make some really good things happen.
It sounds like you're talking about this sort of pump priming thing where once you can demonstrate that you've gotten the money in from Stellar, you could go back to other private funding sources and say, look, we have these other things we want to do. Would you like to help write a check to get those done as well, since they're going to be lumped in with this bigger transformation of the community?
It's all about momentum, you know, and our really our tagline throughout the Stellar proposal was primed for Stellar transformation. And we felt like we had been priming that pump, and now the pump is really taking off. And that is exactly what we will be doing. Wabash College being a partner, you know, we have some really innovative things working there on the entrepreneur side, on the democracy and public discourse side that dovetail into the Stellar. And when you put it all together, you know, it's more attractive to those who might fund a program to see that they can really leverage their dollars with this much bigger program.
Does having to take the money from multiple pots slow you down at all?
In reality, yes, probably. You know, I mean, anytime you involve more and more agencies and groups, it does slow you down. But we're pretty tenacious in how we move forward, and we keep things on track. We keep our nose to the grindstone, and that's not to say it's not frustrating at times, and that's certainly not to say that it moves at the speed I would like to see. But I think we're able to keep it on track and keep progress and keep momentum. So the more you add, the more complicated it does become.
I want to go back to something that you and I have talked about for a couple of months now and that I'm interested in following, and that is reconstituting your city's Human Rights Commission. Have you begun to secure commitments from people? I know you had a list of folks you were thinking about asking. How close are you to having those people say yes?
I've had quite a few say yes. You know, I had about twice as many people express interest as I had spots, according to the ordinance. So that puts you in an interesting situation to really start vetting those and pare those down and say, okay, I'm going to choose these people over these other people. You know, the situation that I'm in with that, I am struggling with it a little bit, because when I look at the group, we've had some really good people express interest, and I'm excited about that. My primary concern, there's not much diversity in that group, and that does trouble me somewhat. So there's not a lot of representation from some of the segments of the community that I would like to see represented. You know, there's some religious diversity in there for sure, and aside from that, there's not a lot. So I've really been thinking through that and how we really try to encourage some more diversity in the people who might be interested in serving.
A lot of times when these sorts of boards are put together, the call goes out, we want to have a diverse representation. I was looking at the demographics of your city this morning, and the latest census said that Crawfordsville is something like 94% white.
Yep.
And so that makes it a fairly homogeneous pool from which you're pulling. And so someone might ask the question of, well, if it's only 6% minority anyway, if you've got 20 people on the board, one person who's from a minority group would equal the amount of participation that's in the city generally. How do you weigh what your demographics are versus what you think the makeup of this board should be to address some of the problems that you and I have talked about that you want to solve in the city?
Well, I think you have to weigh both of those things and really strike a balance. But I will tell you that even if you look at those demographics right now, I'm not there. You know, I'm not even at that, you know, at that one person out of 12 or whatever sitting there. So, you know, there's some work to be done, and you really have to ask yourself, why am I not getting that representation? Is it just not being communicated? Is there some kind of reservation on their part? You know, and you know, I think particularly with our Hispanic and Latino community, I think there's, you know, there's a cultural difference, and their willingness or eagerness to get involved in the government process is not what you might expect out of others, just because there's in general a concern or distrust or fear of government, you know, from their experiences, you know, elsewhere. So
is it possible some of these people think the problem is so intractable that they don't want to get their hands dirty with it?
Well, I hope not, but you obviously must ask yourself that question. I don't see that myself, but I'm not looking from maybe their perspective. So I'm confident I'm going to be reaching out here in the next, you know, in the next week or two to really try to get some more interest. But, you know, we wanted to move this forward a little quicker than what we have, and I know this sounds like the standard excuse. We've kind of been bogged down with Stellar and some other things that have really kind of, you know, taken a lot of my time. But it is moving forward, and it is going to happen for sure.
In just our last minute or so, I want to ask a fun question. The Chamber of Commerce is putting together a time capsule in accordance with next year's bicentennial. What's your office going to put in that?
You know, I'm not sure yet. We'll have to think about that. I don't know. You know, there's a lot going on today. There's a lot we could say about this era that people could look back on down the road. I'm not sure. I don't know.
It would seem like when your city is potentially in 2015, 2016, 2017 going to change the way it looks substantially thanks to Stellar, I wonder if you could put drawings of that in. Or I also wonder, just in our last 30 seconds or so here, you don't seem like an ego-driven guy to me. How do you weigh, you know, how much your administration puts in this capsule?
Well, in my opinion, you have to put something in there that represents the community, and not necessarily my administration or anything like that. What did our community look like right now, or how are we functioning right now? Not necessarily, you know, anything driven towards one group of people.
All right. Well, Mr. Mayor, thanks as always for your time, and we'll look forward to talking with you in October.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. This has been Ask the Mayor on WBAA. A reminder, you can find archived versions of all of our Ask the Mayor programs at WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Support for Ask the Mayor on WBAA comes from your membership and Butler, Fairman & Seifert, a civil engineering firm providing communities with professional expertise and guidance. Butler, Fairman & Seifert, civil engineering solutions for better communities. BFSENGR.com.